You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. A warning for our listeners today. For the first half of the program, we are going to be discussing mental health and suicide, and this may not be appropriate for everyone. If you or someone you know is struggling, there is help. Here's the number to call, 208-398-4357. Again, that is 208-398-4357. Every year, tens of thousands of Americans die by suicide, most of them with a gun. And some of the hardest hit areas spend the least on prevention. For the Guns in America series, In Their Own Hands, Heath Druzan traveled to rural Idaho and met with some of the small town residents stepping in to help.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
Hank Thornton is walking me through the center of Amida, Idaho. Population 684.
They've got a great breakfast here, but no, it's not just to get breakfast.
He's making the rounds at the tiny town's diner and other gathering places to get information and potentially save lives. This is timber country, as evidenced by the fully loaded logging trucks rumbling through town. After leaving Drifters, Thornton walks into Roxborough Inc. It's a consignment store run by his chief intel source in the area, Annette Kay.
Hello, Sunshine.
Hi, baby. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Kay knows just about everyone in town. She especially looks out for the group that also concerns Thornton, veterans.
I was in love with a Vietnam veteran. Came home one day and found him under the bed. And we went through a year of PTSD, partial inpatient, partial outpatient. And I learned a lot about Vietnam that America doesn't want to know.
Kay lets Thornton know if someone needs a knock on the door, a kind word, and information about mental health resources.
If they're struggling with PTSD or whatever, she's the ears and eyes of the community here, and she does a great job.
You see, amid the idyllic forested slopes, soaring peaks, and grazing cattle, a crisis is quietly rippling through Mountain West communities like Amida. Suicide. The region has some of the highest suicide rates in the country, but historically, little state support for suicide prevention and mental health care. For example, Wyoming has the highest suicide rate in the nation, yet it wasn't until August that it stood up its first suicide prevention hotline, the last state in the nation to do so. And here in Idaho, people complete suicide at the fifth highest rate in the country, yet the government spends less per capita on mental health care than all but one other state. That doesn't sit well with Thornton.
How can we rank so high in attempted suicides and fund it so little?
But he and other community members aren't waiting around for the answer. They've taken it upon themselves to step in where the state has failed. For Thornton, that means meeting face-to-face to see what at-risk people need. And, just as importantly, to show them someone cares.
It's okay, you don't have to open the door.
Thornton is checking on a fellow Vietnam veteran. The veteran's away, but Thornton gets an update from his wife.
If you guys need anything, you got my card. Give me a call.
Thank you for your service twice.
Oh.
Thornton is himself a Vietnam veteran, a gun owner, and a member of the local American Legion post. He's 70 years old and retired from a career managing Home Depot stores. He connects to the group most at risk for suicide and often most resistant to help, older men.
They're tough and they're strong and they, you know, take care of things behind closed doors. They don't talk about their issues publicly. And they're very independent people in these communities.
That's Christy Scott, who runs the Suicide Prevention Action Network of Benoit County. The group offers support for suicide survivors and organizes educational events, like the county's first ever suicide awareness and prevention walk this year. Scott's lived in the small logging town of St. Mary's for 25 years, including 16 years as a hairdresser here.
Trust me, I know more than most people would care to know.
She and a friend built a group from nothing last year because they felt they had no choice. They received no state funding, instead surviving on a small grant and donations. Scott said she watched family after family hit by suicide with no local resources to help them.
They're just left picking up the pieces and not knowing where to turn.
Her alarm is justified. Already high suicide rates have been steadily going up in the region over the past decade. And it's not just affecting older people. A recent analysis by gun control advocacy group Every Town for Gun Safety shows youth firearm rates are at an all-time high.
It's just been one of those things where I feel like we've kind of just swept it under the rug and quietly hoped that it would just go away and take care of itself over the years.
The factors affecting suicide rates are complex, but there is one thing that is simultaneously impossible to ignore but difficult to talk about. Firearms. And that's one thing all Mountain West states have in common: higher than average rates of gun ownership. Studies see a correlation between that and suicide. Gun safety is a tough discussion anywhere. Scott says that's especially true in places like this, where firearms are so intricately woven into the culture.
These people raise their children to understand the safety of a firearm and the danger of it as well. But again, you don't know what you don't know. And a lot of times, family members will have someone right under their roof and not know that they're struggling with suicide.
But that tough conversation is much more effective when it comes from neighbors like Scott and Thornton, said Shannon Decker, executive director of the Idaho-based suicide prevention group, the Speedy Foundation.
They need to be somebody who banks in that community. They shop at the grocery store in that community. They are a vital member. They are respected because people need to be able to trust where this information is coming from.
Given Idaho's historic lack of funding for suicide prevention, there's been no choice for a lot of people, Decker said. It took until 2016 for Idaho state government to revamp its prevention efforts and back it up with public funding.
And even then, it was not a well thought out, it was not a well designed, it was not a community approach, it was not an evidence-based approach. It was a scramble.
The Idaho Department of Health and Welfare declined a request for a recorded interview. Instead, Idaho Division of Public Health Administrator Elke Shaw-Tulloch sent a written statement. In it, she acknowledged a lack of prevention funding before 2016, but said the state had made strides since then. She pointed to a 5-year suicide reduction plan launched in 2018 and state support for a suicide prevention hotline. Back on the road with Thornton, he says it was a personal experience with suicide that shaped his thinking. A close friend called him to say goodbye, that he wasn't going to make it. Thornton raced over to his house and found him under his bed with a loaded gun. He convinced his friend to give him his gun and get help. But he's seen too many others who had no one to turn to.
We lost one here in March. We didn't know him. We did his funeral. We did the honor guard for his funeral. Had someone called us. Someone just let us know that he was struggling. Maybe we could have made a difference.
And in small towns across the West, people like Thornton are racing to make that difference. For Guns and America, I'm Heath Drusen.
And we're continuing our look at suicide in the gun-friendly Mountain West with a look at Colorado's fight against this urgent issue. There is a growing movement to put distance between guns and people in crisis. Guns in America reporter Lee Patterson reports.
Damon Hatfield lives in a small town called Craig in northwest Colorado. It's known as the elk hunting capital of the world.
Here's my gun cabinet.
Damon has several guns, some for protection, some hunting rifles, some family heirlooms.
This is what they call a coach gun. This is an antique.
Guns are a normal part of life here. But last summer, Damon gave his away. Now, a year later, he describes the night he made that choice.
So it was about 10 o'clock, and I went to bed, and she had started drinking.
His wife had been drinking a lot. She was struggling with a terminal illness and ongoing mental health issues. On top of that, they were worried about money. This was a rough patch.
It was 4:30 in the morning. I had to get up and use the restroom, and I couldn't find my wife anywhere in the house.
He looked outside.
And there's my wife. She was sitting in the chair on the porch. And I tried to wake her, and I saw the gun on her chest. And it was the worst day of my life right there.
At some point, the police arrived. Then the victim's advocate showed up, and they asked him, "Do you have any guns in the home?"
I'm like, "Well, yeah." And they said, "Well, we need to get them." I'm like, "Okay."
They collected his guns, and then a family member came by to pick them up.
And you're depressed. You blame yourself. Those are dangerous times, and I don't think people need an easy weapon to hurt themselves with, and getting the guns out of the house was a good idea.
That simple act is a potential solution to a huge and growing challenge in many rural areas: how to prevent firearm suicide in a place where firearms are everywhere. In Colorado, the suicide rate is high and growing, and Moffitt County, where Damon lives, has one of the highest rates in the state.
And in our county, individuals are choosing to end their life using firearm. This is just a fact.
Megan Frangone was one of the victim's advocates who showed up to Damon's house that night. Recently, she has been busy. It's been one suicide after another.
I have firearm in my home. I have my concealed carry. or a member of the NRA. I'm not anti-firearm. I am pro-gun safety.
Research shows that the acute period of suicide risk is often brief. Many people take just 5 or 10 minutes to think it through. And because firearms are so lethal, helping separate people from guns during that time is part of Megan's job. She says almost everyone agrees.
Because it's a personal and voluntary choice.
In rural conservative areas like Moffitt County, the voluntary part is key. Take Colorado's Extreme Risk Protection Order law, for example. It allows a judge to order the temporary removal of firearms from someone in crisis. In other words, getting the guns out of the house, but mandated by the state. Many communities have pushed back against this law, including some with the highest suicide rates in the state. Moffitt County and the city of Craig have passed resolutions against it, and the sheriff has questioned its constitutionality.
If you come to Moffitt County with the top-down approach when you're talking about Second Amendment, you will hit a wall. Conversations will end.
The voluntary approach meets people where they are. It can mean getting guns out of the house or locking them up in the house.
Without gun owners' involvement, we're not going to be able to tackle this issue.
This is Kathy Barber's driving philosophy. She studies guns and suicide at Harvard, and she's found that many gun owners are already working on suicide prevention. She gives this example from a firearm safety meeting at a New Hampshire gun shop years ago.
During breaks, I'd hear some of the gun guys on the committee talking to one another.
Saying things like, oh, we stopped by so-and-so's over the weekend to pick up the guns because his son is having a hard time.
And I was like, wait, that's a public health intervention. Like, why don't we just kind of name it and promote it?
The names vary, but momentum behind the idea is building. The Department of Veterans Affairs built a downloadable safe storage toolkit. A range safety officer in Pennsylvania launched a website called holdmyguns.org. Public health experts in a handful of states have mapped out places where people can drop off their guns. This kind of voluntary storage worked for Damon Hatfield, but it did not work for his wife. And this illustrates one of the problems with storage. It's hard to know who shouldn't have access and when.
Yeah. Wow, that's true. You know, I didn't even think about taking the guns out of the house. I kind of trusted her because she was in a bad spot, you know, like a few years ago, and she asked me to take the gun out of the house.
So he did. But eventually, he gave the gun back. There's a meth problem in their town. Damon was worried about break-ins.
Maybe I should have kept the gun out of the house.
Dr. Emmy Betts is an emergency physician at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus who focuses on firearm suicide prevention. She is all about voluntary storage, but I asked her if it really goes far enough to prevent firearm suicide.
Oh, that's a, I don't know, billion-dollar question. I don't know if it goes far enough. I think it is the critical first step.
Because getting rid of all the guns just isn't practical, Betts takes a harm reduction approach, helping gun owners stay safe. She hopes that over time, voluntary storage will become a widespread part of gun culture, complete with a catchphrase, like friends don't let friends drive drunk.
And I don't know what that catchphrase is because I'm not in advertising. But how do we get to the point where it just becomes a norm that if you, if your family member, if your friend is at risk of suicide, one of the things you do is you get the guns out of the house.
So there it is, a cycle of grief.
Damon Hatfield has put in a lot of work to get through his wife's death since last summer. He reads books about grief. He talks about it with his friends and family. He says he cries every day.
How did you know you were ready to get your guns back emotionally?
I pondered over it.
He talked with his family, thought through everything he was doing to feel better, and 4 months after his wife's suicide, he decided he was comfortable.
And most people are like, well, how could you have a gun in your house? How could you even pick one up after this? A gun's a tool. It's like a hammer. But no, I don't blame the gun for this.
So in addition to separating yourself from your guns, Damon has advice for others. Watch for people struggling in your community. And if you're struggling, get help. Talk about it. After we finished talking, Damon walked out the door for a counseling appointment. For Guns and America, I'm Lee Patterson.
Those stories are part of this series from Guns in America collaboration called In Their Own Hands. After the break, we will talk with the reporters on this story to learn more about what's being done to battle suicide here in the Mountain West. I'm Gemma Gaudette. More Idaho Matters next. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Caudette. If you're just joining us, we are talking about suicide in the Mountain West. So before we turn to our two reporters on this topic, if you or someone you know is struggling, we want you to know there is help. Here in Idaho, here is the number for the Idaho Suicide Hotline, 208-398-4357. Again, that number, 208-398-4357. And remember, you do not have to be suicidal to call. If you need help, call. Joining us now are Guns in America reporters Heath Drusen and Lee Patterson. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hi there.
Great to be here.
So Heath, we've talked on this show before about the high suicide rate among Mountain West states, including Idaho and Colorado, the two pieces we just listened to before the break. So can you help us understand the scope of this problem?
Yeah, you know, it's a problem that I think a lot of folks in the Mountain West might not really be aware of. It's really gone under the radar, but this part of the country, it's actually known by some as the suicide belt, which is obviously not a moniker that any place wants to have. But the whole region, every state is well above average when it comes to suicide rates. And Idaho in particular has a pretty bad rate. We're the fifth highest suicide rate in the country. And so really, it's a region-wide crisis, and it's one that it's really been kind of it's kind of been uneven around the region how states have responded to that. So I would say it's a really big public health emergency, and I think complicating that is that a lot of folks just aren't really aware.
Mm-hmm. Heath, do we know if there's something about the Mountain West in particular that makes it ripe for such a high suicide rate?
So suicide is an extremely complex topic. And the factors that go into people attempting suicide are, you know, they're often, it's often more than one thing. And it's not really a very fully understood it's not fully understood. There are a lot of different things that go into it. And there's obviously a lot of misunderstandings about it too. But you know, there is one factor that pretty much everybody agrees is an important one, and that's firearms. So the Mountain West, as I'm sure everybody listening is very aware of, it's a place where a lot of folks own firearms. There are higher rates of firearm ownership just about everywhere here compared to the rest of the country. And studies have shown that higher rates of firearm ownership can have an effect on increasing suicide rates. And that's just sort of the brute fact that firearms are a very lethal means of attempting suicide, as opposed to other means where a lot more folks survive. So it doesn't mean that people necessarily are more prone to it here, but it just means that they have access to much more dangerous means.
Okay, that makes sense. So Lee, I want to bring you into the conversation. You did a story on Colorado that focuses on voluntary storage. I'm curious if that method actually works to reduce suicides. I mean, what does the research show for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in terms of effectiveness, we do know that, there's some research that shows that certain storage laws are associated with a drop in suicide rates, particularly among young people. But when it comes to voluntary storage, you know, getting the guns out of the house in a voluntary way, there is not much research around that topic. One of the people who is looking at it is Kathy Barber. She's from Harvard. She was in one of the stories that we just heard. She surveyed 500 firearms instructors in Utah, and she found that nearly 20% of them said, yeah, we've held onto a gun for someone else over a two-year period. And this is something that I ask gun owners periodically. Some say, yes, we've held onto someone's guns. And oftentimes it's related to a rough divorce, usually something kind of a relationship-based. I've also asked gun stores who offer storage in times of crisis, and many have told me, yeah, this has never been used, or it's rarely used. So I guess an answer to your question, it's really tough to generalize about how effective voluntary storage is because there's just not a lot of quantitative information out there.
So Lee, let's stick with Colorado for a second. At the state level in Colorado, do you believe that there is the political will to work on suicide prevention in a real way?
Yes, absolutely. I think that there is broad and bipartisan agreement that mental health is a serious issue. You know, lawmakers, law enforcement, public health people, they're all like nodding their heads in agreement here. And on suicide, to some extent, this is also true. There are state and local programs aimed at suicide prevention. But where this agreement really breaks down is when we're talking about suicide and firearms. I think one of the examples I mentioned in my story is Colorado's Extreme Risk Protection Order law, which took effect in January. It allows a judge to order the removal of guns from someone in crisis. Mm. And there's been a lot of pushback here. Sheriffs have refused to enforce it. Certain cities and counties have passed resolutions against it. Many people that I've talked to in my reporting are just like kind of vaguely skeptical of the law, even if they don't know a ton about it. So yes, there's agreement and an understanding that mental health and suicide are major issues that need to be tackled, but there is in some ways like very little agreement on how actually to go about solving those problems.
And then Heath, a similar question for you. I mean, you focused on suicide prevention stories in Idaho. Why do you think people in Idaho are taking suicide prevention into their own hands?
Well, the short answer is that historically the state just really hasn't done a great job. There was a long period of time when the state didn't even publicly fund our suicide prevention hotline. And there's been some real uneven efforts over the years at that state level to fund these kinds of programs. I will say that that has gotten better, especially since 2016, when the state unveiled a new five-year plan to tackle suicide prevention. There has been more public funding. But what's happening in these rural communities that I've been reporting in is basically they just didn't have any resources. And the folks that I was talking to who are taking it upon themselves, and I should make clear, on a purely voluntary basis, what they tell me is if we don't do it, then nobody will. There's just nobody there who's helping folks, especially survivors, you know, family members who might be dealing with the loss of a loved one. These folks were seeing that they really had no one to turn to. Some of these communities are very remote. They don't necessarily have great mental health resources. In St. Mary's, for example, if you wanted to go to a suicide survivor group, you had to drive an hour or more to get to Coeur d'Alene. And it's kind of a different world. You know, St. Mary's is kind of out on its own. You really don't go there you don't end up there on your way anywhere else. And, you know, people live out in those areas because they want to be out in rural Idaho. So yeah, basically they did it because they felt they didn't have a choice. If you don't start your own organization in some of these communities, then a lot of people are going to be on their own.
So I do want to end on something positive from both of you, because this is an incredibly heavy topic. Heath, we did not play this piece, but you did report on a public awareness campaign in Utah that is having some success in reducing suicides. So can you talk to us a little bit about a couple of the lessons maybe learned there and why it seems to be working?
Yeah, a lot of public health experts, specifically suicide prevention experts, point to Utah as kind of a model. And certainly Utah being similar to other Mountain West states like Idaho could be especially helpful for us. They have completely revamped their suicide prevention efforts. And what they've done is something that Lee really touched on. They went to gun owners themselves and said, hey, work with us. And the other thing they've done is done a really data-driven approach. So they're constantly collecting data on what's happening with suicide attempts and completed suicides and seeing what's happening there and adjusting their program to try to be most effective. But really, you know, what they've done is basically brought gun owners in and help them craft not only their program, but even their PSAs. You know, they have these ads, these suicide prevention ads, and some of them are actually co-written by gun owners, and a lot of them are actually, you know, have gun owners as the central figures telling other gun owners, hey, you know, here's how to be safer with your weapons and protect yourself and your family.
And Lee, what sort of bright spots did you find in this reporting that you did?
Yeah. So I think firearm suicide is a really tough topic. It is controversial. Yeah. It's really sad. It's hard to talk about. And the people I interviewed for this story on the record and on background, they're putting themselves out there. They're doing really hard work because they care about it. For example, Dr. Emmy Betts, she's an emergency physician here in Colorado. When she first started working on suicide prevention, working with gun owners kind of in a harm reduction way, not counseling them to give up their guns, other physicians thought she was making a bad ethical choice. She received a lot of pushback, but she continued on because it was important to her. Damon Hatfield, the man who lost his wife and who agreed to give up his guns, he spoke so openly and in such a vulnerable way about that trauma and the work that he's done since she died. And I have to say, I so admired the work that he has put in and the value he's placed on his own happiness and working through and living with what happened to him. And I think, you know, the last thought, and I think it's always really important to acknowledge this. We talk about suicide deaths because the numbers are so high and because the aftermath is so devastating for so many people. But for everyone who does die, there are so many people who struggle and who think about suicide and who don't die. And they survive and they go on to live, you know, successful, resilient lives. And I think it's important to remember that.
Yeah. I want to thank both of you for the work that you've put in on this and for, of course, being on the show to talk about it more. We have been talking with Guns in America reporters Lee Patterson and Heath Drusen. You can find links to all of their stories on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Click on the News tab to find Guns in America. Thank you both for your time.
Thanks, Gemma.
And remember, if you or someone you know is struggling, there is help. You can call the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline, 208-398-4357. Again, 208-398-4357. More Idaho Matters next.